Coming to you from New York City, it's the Friars Club Podcast. Established in 1904, the Friars Club is the birthplace of the celebrity roast and has counted the likes of Frank Sinatra, Jimmy Fallon, Billy Crystal, Barbara Streisand, and Johnny Carson among its members. So come on in for a drink and some laughs with your host, Joe Sibilia.
Hello and welcome to the Friars Club Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sibilia, and if you don't know the name Jeffrey Gurian, you most definitely should, because not only is he one of the great stand-up comics, he's also a fabulous comedy writer. He has worked with so many of the greats of stand-up comedy, as you're going to find out. He's an author and, believe it or not, a dentist, and you're probably wondering how someone went from being a dentist to becoming a comedy writer to becoming a stand-up comic. Well, you're going to find out on this episode of the Friars Club Podcast with my guest, Jeffrey Gurian. Jeffrey, thank you for joining me today. How are you?
I'm great, Joe, and thanks so much for inviting me on. I'm really excited to talk about the Friars.
Jeffrey, I'm so honored to have you on. I met you at the Friars Club. I knew about you before I ever even met you at the Friars Club. Your name has a lot of esteem in the comedy community. You are very much a beloved member of the world of show business. So I want to start by asking how you first became involved in that world. I know you were a dentist, you went to dental school, and how does one get into show business by way of dentistry?
The dental school thing was a nasty rumor, and you know when it started?
When?
The day I graduated from dental school. and it never let up the whole time.
Right.
All Jewish guys, they all accuse us of being dentists. I didn't know that you could just go into show business. I thought you had to go to dental school first.
Right.
It would have saved me a lot of trouble, Joe. When I was 12 years old, I must have been a really weird kid. When I was 12 years old, I already knew I wanted to be a doctor, but I knew I was too sensitive to handle life and death situations. So I was wearing braces at the time. And I said, you know what? I'll be a dentist. I'll make people look beautiful. And I was already writing comedy at 12 years old. And it used to confuse me. I'm like, I want to be a dentist, but I want to be in comedy. But who ever heard of doing both? I used to lay in bed thinking about how am I going to do this as a kid? And, you know, most 12-year-olds have no idea what they want to do in life. And somehow I never changed my mind, and somehow I made it happen. I can't even explain how it happened. But when I was writing for Joan Rivers, she didn't know. And I thought she knew because we had met at a Friars roast, and her representative called me and she said, Joan would like to talk to you about writing for her. So I said, oh, that's great. And then, so she invited me to her home. And in those days, people weren't treating comedy writers with tremendous respect. So I figured if she invited me to her home, she knows I'm a doctor and she's giving me that respect, right?
Right.
So I show up at her house and the doorman says to me, you'll have to wait a few minutes because Joan just sprained her ankle and she's in a lot of pain. And I thought to myself, what a great break for me. I can write her a prescription for painkillers. No other comedy writer could do that. I'll be a hero and she'll want to work with me.
Yes.
So he finally tells me to go upstairs and she's there with a group of people and she introduces me to everyone as Mr. Gurian. So I realize she doesn't know. We get along great. She winds up hiring me and I'm writing for her. A few months down the line, she calls me at my dental office one morning from Las Vegas. Now my nurse had strict instructions, never interrupt me when I'm with a patient unless it's for show business.
You have your priorities straight.
Yeah, so she would come in and she'd be like, Dr. Burrell is on the phone. Dr. Lewis is calling. The only one no one believed was Dr. Dangerfield.
Right.
No one believed that there could be a Dr. Dangerfield. So Joan calls and I step out of the room for a minute. And she says to me, what do you do during the day? And I said, well, I work. And she said, well, obviously you work, but what is it that you do? And I realized that she knew because an article had come out about me in the New York Times, and I was getting a lot of press at the time. And it turns out that her assistant, whose name was Robin at that time, had seen me on TV. A lot of shows were doing stories about my dual careers. So I said to Joan, is this concerning the vicious rumor going around that I'm a dentist? I said, I've heard of accusing people of a lot of things, but that's really low, Joan. And she's like, why didn't you ever tell me? And I said, because no one hires you in show business because you're a dentist. They hire you in spite of the fact.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, I love it. I think it's great. And so from that time on, my secret was gone, you know. But I used to hide it because I wanted people to take me seriously in comedy. I didn't want to be a novelty. Like on the Ed Sullivan Show, he'd have knife throwers and plate spinners. And I didn't want to be that. I wanted to be taken seriously as a comedy writer, because I wasn't performing yet in those days. And so I thought to myself, if I'm a dentist, I better write for very famous people, or else no one's going to take me seriously.
So who was the first comedian that you wound up writing for?
Dick Capri.
Oh, he's great. He's a funny guy. Catskills on Broadway.
Catskills on Broadway, one of the, you know, I wanted to say oldest Friars. He happens to just have celebrated his 90th birthday, God bless him. But he was the first guy that used my material and paid me for it. And you know how I got started in comedy? It was through Alan Zweibel, another famous Friar.
Right.
So I drove up to 30 Rock. Saturday Night Live had just started. And I was making crazy films on the street with my Super 8 camera. And I was making like these like false news items where like several men were arrested for smearing cream cheese on the ankles of elderly women who wore their stockings rolled down like bagels.
Right.
If you ever see the old women with the stockings.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they looked like bagels to me. So I begged, my grandmother had a great sense of humor. She and my grandfather owned a nightclub in the Bronx. And I think that's where I got my taste for show business. Growing up, all our family events were at this nightclub. It was called the Red Mill. And years later, when I met Milton and those guys, Jerry Lewis, they all knew about the Red Mill. It was a hot spot in the 40s and 50s in the Bronx. So I got my dear grandmother to let me put cream cheese on her ankles. And she made believe she had a Jewish accent. And she said to me, you know, in the Jewish religion, we have two kind of stockings, one for milk and one for meat. She goes, and this crazy man, he smeared cream cheese on my meat stockings and I can't get it off. And I zoom in with my Super 8 camera on the cream cheese on the ankles. To this day, decades later, Alan Zweibel says he can't get that image out of his mind. cream cheese on the ankles. So anyway, I drive up to 30 Rock in this car. I have these films on a VHS tape. And I drive up to the front and I had a CB radio in the shape of a phone. There was no cell phones in those days. This was probably 1977.
Right.
Saturday Night Live was around for a year or two, started in 75. So I pull up in front. I throw the doorman a few bucks. Now, when you pull up in a car like that, by the way, in those days, you could pull right up to the door at 30 Rock. Now it's been closed off for many years because of terrorism. But in those days, everything was safe. And so I pulled up in front of the door as if I was on the phone because I'm on this CB radio. And the doorman say, and I throw the doorman a few bucks and I say, watch my car. Lorne Michaels is expecting me. I had a lot of nerve in those. Lorne Michaels had no idea who I was. He never heard of me, right? And I sneak past security. If you tried that now, they'd probably shoot at you. But in those days, you could do it. I sneak past security, get in the elevator, go up to Saturday Night Live. I get out of the elevator. Alan Zweibel is playing handball on the wall with a guy named Neil Levy, who is Lorne Michaels' cousin. He was one of the producers of SNL. We were all kids in those days.
Right.
So they were playing hot handball on the wall. I'll never forget it. So I introduce myself to him, and I tell him I got these films that I made, and I want to show him. Alan brings me inside. He looks at the films. He goes, these are really funny. I never saw anything like this. I did a thing called The Masters of Disguise. It was two master criminals who disguised themselves as inanimate objects to commit their crime. So it starts out with two men disguised as coats rob a hat store. They come in over the arms of two other men and they say, just act natural like wear your coats and nobody will get hurt, right?
Yeah.
And police draw composite drawings of the coats of the two men, and it's two coats, you know? It's like a dark trench coat and a raincoat, whatever. And so I had this whole VHS film of all my crazy films. And Alan Zweibel did one of the nicest things for me. He didn't just give me the number of his manager. he called him for me, longtime friar David Jonas, who passed away at 100 years old a few years ago, who at the time was managing Freddie Prinze Sr. and got Freddie Prinze the TV show Chico and the Man.
Right.
And David Jonas was managing Freddie Roman and Dick Capri and all those Catskill comics. I don't even like to refer to them as that because some people think it's a derogatory term. But years ago, there were very few places for people to perform. You know, until Bud Friedman opened the Improv in 1963, there were no comedy clubs. Comedians performed in nightclubs and hotels and things like that. So performing at the big hotels in the Catskills was a great honor if you were good enough to perform in those places. So David Jonas spent about a year trying to talk me out of show business. He goes, "You're a doctor. What do you need this for? What are you, crazy?" And I was like, "No, but this is what I do." So it took me about a year to learn how to craft a joke because I'm thinking cream cheese on the ankles, and you can't do that on stage. That doesn't translate. It's very visual. When Woody Allen read my earliest material while I was still in dental school, and he was the first one to tell me that my stuff is very visual and that I should think of making a film out of it, which I did some years later. I did a series of very bizarre films called the Men Who series, and it was about men who do very unusual things.
And you discovered Peter Dinklage for one of these. How did you find him?
I met him through Ethan Hawke. I was one of the writers. There was a theater troupe called Naked Angels. They still exist. But in those days, they were new. They had a theater on 17th Street. And it was Marissa Tomei, Sarah Jessica Parker, Matthew Broderick, Fisher Stevens, a bunch more. All went on to become superstars, very, very famous. But in those days, they were new. They were just, and they would have this, like, Tuesday night, they would read plays and things that young writers would write. And I used to go down there with Federico Castelluccio, who went on to become one of the Sopranos, you know, and a guy named Billy Goins, who was engaged to, I think, Heidi Klum, maybe one of the supermodels. We used to go down. I got to know all those people. It's where I met Ethan Hawke. And so they used to read my stuff. And I think it was through Ethan that I met Peter Dinklage. So I'm doing these films, and I invited in Gilbert Gottfried and Richard Belzer and my friends at the time. And the films were like men who take a pitchfork to the movies, men who enjoy Latin dancing with tools. You've probably seen a lot of Latin dancing with tools, but I had a guy who did the tango with a wrench that was unbelievable. And he did the merengue with an extension ladder. So I did a film called Men Who Dance Where They're Not Supposed To. And I had a great artist, and he took a no parking sign and he made an exact duplicate of the no parking sign. But this sign said no dancing Tuesday and Thursday or any other time. And we put that sign up, I think it was on 25th Street and Broadway. And we accidentally left it up after the shoot, and it caused a tremendous traffic jam because it's always been hard to find a spot in New York. And drivers were pulling up to look at the sign and they see no dancing. And it wound up on page 6. And I thought I was going to get in trouble because they wrote that it was my film. I was very nervous about that. I asked Peter Dinklage to star in it, and he agreed. And this was years before so many years before Game of Thrones. Whoever thought he would become one of the biggest stars in the world, right?
Oh, absolutely. Elf, he's great in that movie as Miles Finch, the author.
He's great in everything that he does. So he gets arrested for dancing in a no-dancing zone. and he's dancing with a guy named Joe. Oh, I'm blanking on his name. He used to do the trauma films. He was 500 pounds. And unfortunately, he passed away in recent years. But they were dancing uncontrollably. And a cop comes over and arrests them. And it was a great scene. It's on my YouTube channel. If people who are listening to this want to see it, if they go to Comedy Matters TV on YouTube, youtube.com/Comedy Matters TV, I have 580 videos with everybody from Jimmy Fallon on down. And if they look up the Men Who series, they'll see Peter Dinklage dancing in a no dancing zone. So anyway, that's how I got started in comedy, from Alan Zweibel. He sent me to David Jonas. It was all about the Friars. And then that was 1977. By 78, I had already learned how to write jokes. And I was writing for Capri and for Freddie Roman and for anyone else that he was handling at the time. There was a bunch of other comics. I was writing for all of them. And I think it was David who brought me to the Friars Club. And I think my first Friars roast that I wrote for was Jim Dale. I have a feeling, if you look it up, the Broadway star Jim Dale, probably 78, because I remember getting a call at my dental office and they said, we need jokes immediately. You have to go to Jim Dale's house tonight. And I left my dental office early. I may have canceled a patient or two. And I ran down to sit with Jim Dale in his apartment and write jokes, because I think the roast was the next day. As I recall this, it was an emergency. And I ran down and I saved the day. And from that time on, I was the main writer for the Friars Roast for the next 12 years. Bob Sachs was producing the roast in those days. If you know the name Bob Sachs.
Right.
S-A-S, I think his grandfather was Sachs Fifth Avenue.
Oh, okay.
And Bob had great connections. He's the one who got all the big stars to come in to be roasted. And he was a very odd guy, but he and I, and, you know, when I first came in, Walter Goldstein was the dean of the Friars Club. And I think Jean-Pierre Trabeau was still the executive director. He was the executive director for many, many years.
Right.
And we would sit late into the night, me and Bob Sachs and Jean-Pierre Trabeau, planning the roasts and who is going to say what and who is on the dais. And they would send me the list of the dais. I pulled out things. In a drawer near me, I have so much memorabilia. The Friars honor Alan King, May 13th, 1989. They would create these memorial books, the New York Friars Club tribute to Red Buttons. These are pristine condition.
Oh, it's Steve Allen is the master of ceremonies.
Yeah, there's not even a wrinkle in these. Steve, and this is the program and the seating chart for them. You can see there was alphabetical seating, and thousands of people used to show up.
That's incredible.
This was from May 16th of 1987 at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. I probably have more memorabilia, maybe than anybody, from the Friars Club, because I was so impressed about being there. It was such an honor to be at the Friars Club in those days. I can't tell you. I can't even express how exciting it was for me as a young man to be taken into the Friars. And Milton Berle was my sponsor.
Right.
And I'd be sitting in the dining room and Milton would be telling me stories about his teeth, about how much he was spending on implants. And all. He loved the fact of my other career.
Did you ever offer to do some work for Milton?
No. His work was very complicated and he lived in L.A. But when I was in L.A., he took me to his home.
That's incredible. I was reading about that.
He said he had 6 million jokes, like kinescopes and all. I mean, you know, the old time stuff. He had a separate building on his property just for all the jokes that he had, that he had collected. But in this one, you know, there are names in here. Well, Abe Beam was
the mayor of New York.
Danny Aiello, Lucille Ball, Milton Berle, Red Buttons, Kitty Carlisle Hart, Howard Cosell, Norm Crosby, Billy Daniels, Eddie Fisher. All these people showed up. Anthony Quinn, Leroy Neiman, Robert Merrill, Jackie Mason, Peggy Lee, just on and on. Every big star in those days, Buddy Hackett, you know, they would all come. And the entertainment, the people who actually roasted him were Lucille Ball, Gene Bayless, who used to spit out chiclets like they were his teeth.
Right.
Knew that about him. Milton Berle, Len Carreyrou, Howard Cosell, Norm Crosby, Buddy Hackett, and Peggy Lee and Robert Merrill were the speakers that year. Then I have one where Milton Berle, this is a beautiful presentation book also. Milton was honored as the man of the year. And this was at the Waldorf Astoria again, April 20th, 1985. The Friars honor Milton Berle. And as you can see, it's like brand new, like it just came off the printing press. And it's got Milton with everybody, with Lucille Ball, Angie Dickinson, Red Buttons, all the stars of that day, Jan Murray, Tom Jones. I can't even believe that I have these. You know, they belong in a museum.
I know that you were, for the Chevy Chase roast in, I believe, 1990, the liaison to Saturday Night Live. Now, what did your duties entail as the liaison to SNL, and what was that like to work with some of the greats like Phil Hartman on that roast?
It was a great question. It started a very close friendship with Phil Hartman that lasted until his demise, his unfortunate demise. No young guys had done roasts before. It was an older comedian's medium. And I believe it was 1990 or 1991, as you said. We roasted Chevy three times. The last time was he was very hurt by what went on. But on this first time, I was the liaison to Saturday Night Live, because SNL was still considered a new groundbreaking show in those days, even though it had been on the air since 75, now it's 1990, but they were considered like the hippest comics around. We were all hanging out at a place called Columbus Cafe, socially. John Lovitz would come there a lot, you know, and John and I got very close. As a matter of fact, when I did the show Gotham Comedy Live, John happened to be the host that night and got to introduce me, which was really cool, because he said, how long we knew each other and how long we were friends. So it was Phil Hartman, Dana Carvey, and Kevin Nealon were all performing on that roast, and they had never done a roast before. So they assigned me to teach them what to do. And I got very friendly with Phil Hartman. You know, it's very hard to stay in character. I think Phil did Donald Trump at that roast. I'm not 100% positive, but I think that was the character that he did.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
And it was very hard to stay in character for a long time. You know, you could do a quick impression, but we talked about Phil was one of the best. He was one of the most respected people in comedy. To this day, you know, people say Phil Hartman was one of the best that Saturday Night Live ever had. They called him the glue. He was the glue that held the sketches together. And we got so friendly that I wound up writing for him on a regular basis. I have pictures of him with him sitting in my apartment at my piano. I have this white baby grand piano. And Phil was amazing. So I got to work with them all to make sure that they were comfortable doing the roast. I think Dana did Church Lady that day. And I don't remember what Kevin did. I think he did the guy who mixes up words. He's fantastic at that. When he puts
Kevin Nealon is hilarious. I think he's
Kevin Nealon, but that cemented my friendship, especially with Kevin and with Phil. And I was supposed to see Phil the weekend that he was killed. I was out in LA. That was 1998. I was out there for a month. I was staying at the Oakwood Apartments. And I remember Phil inviting me. I remember being on the phone with him. He said, why don't you come down to Malibu for the weekend? And I told my mom that I was going to see Phil for the weekend. That was the weekend that his wife killed him. And I don't remember why I didn't go, because it was so exciting that he invited me. I don't remember. Maybe I didn't feel well. I remember getting sick while I was out there. I didn't go. My mother called me, I think it was Monday morning, and woke me up. And she called in a panic. And she said, thank God, you're okay? And I'm like, why? What are you talking about? And she told me what happened to Phil. And I was in shock. I couldn't believe it, you know, to hear that horrible story. And I even called, I remember, I couldn't believe it. I called his cell phone. There was no cell phones, I don't think. I called his, whatever phone number I had, his answering machine picked up. They had left it on for several days just to hear his voice. I couldn't believe that he was gone. We had just had such a long conversation telling me so many different things about what he was doing. And then he invites me down. And who knows what would have happened if I had gone to see him. If I had been in that house, I might not be here talking to you now, because Well, just because of what happened. I don't even want to talk much about Bryn. It was just a horrible, horrible thing that happened. And we had hung out. We hung out socially. Bryn and Phil and me and my girlfriend at the time, we would go to Saturday Night Live together. Phil invited us over. And at the time, I was doing these films for Playboy TV. And Gilbert Gottfried was in them, and Richard Belzer was in them, Phoebe Legere, Pat Cooper, longtime Fryer.
Oh, yes, I've met Pat. He's a character.
Fryer staple. Thank God he's around still. And
living out in Las Vegas now, I think.
I think so. I think so. He was very big in Las Vegas. When I went to see Jerry Lewis, he came with me. He was living in Vegas at that. Well, I think he had a place there. And he, and I think his wife's name was Patty. He came with me to see Jerry Lewis. Because after I wrote for Jerry's Friar's Roast,
right,
we stayed in touch for a while. We were friends. I got to spend two nights with Jerry Lewis in his hotel room, writing his speech for his Friar's Roast.
Now, this was in 1986 that you worked on Jerry's Roast?
Yes, and I have pictures dated when he wrote pictures to thank me. I think it said, I can still hear the ocean. I wrote him some very nasty kind of a joke. He didn't like doing what Milton would call blue humor.
Right.
He liked to work clean. But one of my greatest stories was I'm sitting with Jerry Lewis in his hotel room, preparing for the roast, just the two of us. No one else was there. And he gets a phone call. They discovered the gene that caused the Duchenne form of muscular dystrophy. And he started crying. Tears were running down his face. And it's just he and I alone there. And I had that moment to share with him. Such a rare opportunity, a rare moment to share. It's happened to me a few times. I was sitting with Jeffrey Ross in Montreal at the Just for Laughs Festival when they told him that his movie Patriot Act won for the best film at the festival. And it was just me and Jeffrey alone having lunch. So I've had the opportunity to share some very special moments with some very special people. But that time with Jerry Lewis was truly amazing.
Now, among some of the other comedians I know you wrote for one of my favorites, Rodney Dangerfield, and I know he used some of your jokes on The Tonight Show. How did you get connected with Rodney? And was it difficult to write in his voice, those really sharp, no respect one-liners that he used to do?
It was one of the most fun gigs I ever had, to be honest with you. I think I met him through Dick Capri, because Dick was performing at Rodney's a lot in those days. Jackie Mason was performing there. He was unknown. He couldn't even fill the room, couldn't fill Dangerfield's. I remember meeting him by the bar one night. But Dick had introduced me to Rodney and told him I was a funny writer. And I will never forget the first check I got from Rodney. And he was doing my stuff on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And I would write him jokes like, you know, we would have, first of all, we'd hang out in his dressing room. And he's wearing just the pajamas, a bathrobe and pajamas, and not a fancy bathrobe and pajamas.
Like a terry cloth type of thing?
Like an old bathrobe and pajamas. You know, I have a great interview with Robert Klein on my channel that blew up in the last few days. I don't know. Robert was my guest at SiriusXM, but also a longtime Fryer. He was always at Fryer's events. I got a great interview with him and Checky Green at one of the Friars events. The one where Gilbert was so outrageous that people walked out and threatened to quit the Friars.
Oh, I've heard. And wasn't Checky one of them?
Yes, Checky was incensed. He was so filthy, Gilbert. And I brought Checky on SiriusXM. I was a regular on Ron Bennington's show in those days. And I brought on more than 40 guests, friends of mine, like Trevor Noah and D.L. Hughley and Artie Lang and all, you know, Danny Aiello. I brought on actors. Tony Danza came on as a favorite to me. And but I have an interview where Robert is talking about Rodney that got about 40,000 views in the last couple of days. I don't know what stirred it up, but suddenly this one interview, and I said I have 580 interviews. This one interview is blowing up all over. 400 or 500 views an hour. About Rodney, about Robert Klein talking about the truth about Rodney, about how he grew up and with his kids and stuff. And he had a very hard upbringing. And he was an aluminum siding salesman with his best friend, Joe Ansis, who I got to meet and hang out with. Joe Ansis was supposedly the funniest guy that never went on stage. They used to hang out at a diner, and Joe Ansis used to hold court. And he had a very unusual way of speaking, like a bebop kind of guy, like from the 50s, like a beatnik.
Yeah.
They spoke in a very different way. And I met him through Rodney, you know? And I wrote jokes for him like, I don't do a good Rodney, but Robert Klein does a great Rodney. He's like, hey, you know, Rodney had a way of starting off jokes that he liked.
I'm all right now, but last week I was in rough shape, you know? I mean, last week I bought a Whirlpool for my bath. So far, I lost three of my best ships.
Well, he liked that joke so much, he used it as his opening line with Carson, which meant so much. And he paid me $250 for that one line, which in those days was unheard of.
Oh, it was crazy money back then.
But he liked it so much, and he did it with Johnny Carson. You know, because when Rodney went on Carson, he wasn't a conversationalist. He would do jokes in his act, and then he would do more jokes when he sat on the couch.
And it was almost funnier when he sat on the couch and did that material with Carson than it was when he did the stand-up center stage in front of the curtain.
And one of his favorite jokes that I wrote for him, it was interesting. They always say, be a minimalist when you write jokes. Try and use as few words as possible to get to the punchline. So I wrote him this joke. He goes, you know, I'm all right now, but last week was rough. He said, I went into one of those custom bed shops. I said to the salesman, what kind of bed would you recommend for a guy like me? He said, single.
That's good.
That was it. A one-word punchline. Rodney loved it. Oh, he loved it. So we had such a blast. And then I used to bring him tons of jokes because you had to write a lot of jokes because he was very selective. And I always remembered saying to him, Rodney, look at all the jokes I brought you. And he goes, yeah, Jeff, but they got to be funny, you know? And I was like,
quality, not quantity.
Oh, I didn't realize they had to be funny also. I thought they just had to be jokes, you know.
Yeah.
He was very particular, but he was the first big star that I ever wrote for, and that kind of gave me credibility in the industry, because when somebody like that was doing your jokes on TV, that was a big deal, you know. So it kind of made me what they called an industry name.
Now, we've talked about many of the older comedians that you've worked with, but you have encountered and met so many of the new crop, and I'll just go through a couple of the names I'm sure people know. As you've mentioned, Jimmy Fallon, Kevin Hart, Hasan Minhaj, and you were pranked by one of my favorite comedians, John Mulaney, and also Nick Kroll. What is the story behind this? Now, you're showing me a jacket, and I love this. It's not Guardian Angels, it's Gurion Angels. And it looks just like the type of jacket that Curtis Sliwa and the Guardian Angels wear.
It's an exact replica of the Guardian Angels jacket. When they did the Oh Hello show, I had the honor of opening the show for them when they did it on Broadway. Nick Kroll and John Mulaney are two dear friends now. I was at a party one night. Well, I don't remember what kind of event. It was a comedy event. I just remember that Chevy Chase was there. He didn't often come out to events, but he was there. Nick Kroll and John Mulaney approached me and they said, would you mind if we took a picture with you? And I said, of course not. You know, why would I ever mind something like that? They made it their Facebook page. They were aware of me, but I wasn't really aware of them in those days. Who knew that they would go on to become so huge?
Huge stars now.
And Nick said to me, if I ever had a TV show, would you be on it? And I said, of course. Many years later, I'm sitting at the desk where I'm sitting talking to you now, and my phone rings, and it's a producer from Los Angeles and says, Nick Kroll would like to know if you would come out to LA to be on Kroll Show. And I was like, I'm leaving now. I'm like, yes, of course, I will be there. And I'm the very first person to be pranked with Too Much Tuna, which is one of their favorite sketches where they prank people with a huge tuna sandwich. It's about 10 inches high. And I hold the honor of being the very first person. And when we did the show in Montreal at the Just for Laughs Festival, which is the biggest comedy festival in the world, they did a reenactment of the show. They had me wear this jacket, which I didn't explain to you yet, but they had me give the tuna sandwich to Judd Apatow. Also, I consider a dear friend who is the king of Hollywood.
Oh, definitely.
the king of Hollywood comedy movies. I mean, unbelievable that I would even know Judd Apatow. So in the Oh Hello Show, they referenced Curtis Sliwa. Now, they didn't know that I used to be Curtis Sliwa's dentist. That's how long we go back.
I know Curtis.
Probably I know Curtis more than 30 years. When he was married to Lisa, they both used to come to my office. And Curtis and I have stayed friends all this time. And so they used to reference Curtis in the Oh Hello Show. When they were talking about New York, they talk about Curtis and the Guardian Angels. So they make me this jacket. They made me the head of security. But my jacket, it looks just like Curtis's, but mine says Guardian Angels. And they made T-shirts. They had two models wearing Guardian Angels T-shirts for this big press conference that they held to announce their Broadway show. And so, as a surprise, I brought Curtis Sliwa to the show one night. They didn't know that I even knew him. And I brought him, and that night, Fred Armisen was the guest. They would always have a guest that they would prank with too much tuna. And so I didn't know that it had been Fred Armisen's dream to meet Curtis Sliwa. He was a big fan of his. And I have pictures of all of us together after the show with Curtis wearing his jacket, I'm wearing my jacket, Nick and John, and Fred Armisen.
That's just funny.
Just a fantastic, fantastic experience. So we always stay in touch. I saw Nick recently. He actually performed at a temple in Westchester where he was friendly with the rabbi. But one of my greatest times was when Nick sold out Carnegie Hall last year. He was very excited. He sold out Carnegie Hall. I didn't tell him I was coming. I wanted to surprise him. So at the end of the show, they still had COVID restrictions. Everyone had to wear a mask for the whole show. It was crazy. And I said to one of the ushers, how do you get backstage? Well, I don't know who they thought I was, but they started clearing people away as if I was the president of the United States. The usher started yelling out to hundreds of people in the hallway. They're yelling, move to the left, move to the left. And they guide me into this private elevator and they take me up to the level where Nick Kroll's dressing room is. Now, I expect a huge crowd there because usually after somebody does a show, there's a lot of people there to congratulate them. There's nobody in the hall. So I'm alone. So I knock on the door very hesitantly and I hear laughter from inside. And he's like, who is it? And I said, it's Gurion. And then the laughter increases and Nick opens the door and a flashbulb goes off. There's a celebrity photographer in there, Marcus Russell Price, who shoots all the big comedy shows. He gets a picture of me coming through the door. And it's only me and Kroll and his agent, Mike, from the William Morris Agency. And they're hysterical laughing. And Kroll's like, they wouldn't even let my family in to see me because of COVID, but they let this man in. And he takes out his phone and he starts to film me for Instagram. And he puts up a story that even his parents couldn't get in, but they let me in. And it wound up on page 6 in the New York Post. They did a big story about it, that no one could get in to see him, but they let me in. And I felt embarrassed, actually. I'm like, why should they let me in? They don't even let his family. Thank God they let his wife in when she came.
Yeah.
That would be really horrible if they didn't even let his wife in, but they let me in. Yeah,
exactly. So,
we got a great laugh out of it.
But you've gotten a lot of entree to a lot of very exclusive rooms. Did you not somehow get into the opening of the Billy Crystal room at the Friars Club? I feel like I read this story someplace. I think this was you that this happened to.
Billy, well, you know how I met Billy? It was crazy. Frank, who was the maitre d', didn't want to let people in. And it's interesting that you know that story. He tried to bar me from entering the room. And Billy saw me. He goes, no, let him in. Because Jack Rollins was the one who introduced me to Billy Crystal. Many years before, when I first connected to Jack Rollins, he was handling Woody Allen, Billy Crystal, and Robin Williams. And he thought that Billy Crystal should play me in a sitcom. He thought it was great. He loved the idea of a dentist in show business. And so he said to me, write something. So I wrote a pilot called First Impressions. about a dentist who wanted to be in show business.
That's a good name, First Impressions.
First Impressions, yeah. I thought so too. And it was, I thought it was a great pilot. And Jack loved it. And he said, but he could only handle it if he handled the star. So he thought Billy Crystal would be perfect to play me. And that's how I met Billy. And that's why in my book on the comic strip, Make 'Em Laugh, there's a picture of me and Billy, and he's pointing to his teeth. I went out to Beverly Hills to interview Billy in his office. Most of the comedians like Seinfeld and Jim Gaffigan and Paul Reiser, they all came into the comic strip to sit with me so I could interview them for the book. But Billy was one, he was out in LA, and he was the first comic to hit the stage on opening night. He was the first comic on stage. So I wanted Billy to be in the book. So I got permission to go to his office in Beverly Hills, and we took these pictures. And he's pointing to his teeth because he remembered. He knew. He goes, he didn't remember at first. He goes, my God, I know you. Alan King used to call you the funny dentist. And I hated that. I never liked being referred to as the funny dentist.
Right.
I didn't want to combine those two things. So that night that they were dedicating the bar to Billy Crystal, Frank was very strict about letting people in. And he was trying not to let me in until Billy Crystal came over and saved me. He goes, no, you have to let Jeffrey in. And that's how I got in.
And didn't they have like a velvet rope in front of where the room is? And yes. For those who don't know, when you walk into the Friars Club, the Billy Crystal room is on the first floor. If you're looking at the door from inside, it's to the right of the front door. And it's a little bar in there. And as I understand, there was a velvet rope locking it off. And I guess Rob Reiner was one of the people there in the room. And it was all Billy's friends.
All Billy's friends. And they were very, very strict about who they were letting in. And I was like, you know, I didn't want to say, but luckily Billy saw me. It's a small room. And he was standing by the bar and he saw me and he came over and told Frank, you got to let him in. And so he let me in.
That's great.
He did the same thing with Jerry Lewis because, you know, when they dedicated the monastery to Jerry Lewis.
Right.
This was
back in 2014, I believe.
Yeah, in more recent years, I remember I was outside there with Al Roker. For some reason, he was wearing a construction hat that night. And Lisa Lampanelli, who was a very dear friend.
Gilbert Gottfried was there. Joe Franklin was there.
We were all there for the renaming of the monastery. And Jerry was old at the time. He brought his dog. And they were very selective about who could come in to see him. And I brought the old pictures of me with Jerry, and that's how they finally let me in. Because I have pictures with Jerry when he, like from 1986, when I wrote, when he was roasted and I got to work with him. It was a very, very special thing. So the Friars Club could be very strict at times of who they let in. In those days, you couldn't do an event bringing in outside people. You had to get special permission to bring people in from outside. Because I always wanted to do like young comedian shows and stuff. And they were very reluctant to do anything like that. They used to say to me, bring in new people. I brought in some members. I remember I brought in Raul Julia as a member, which is an odd name, not in comedy. But I knew him, I guess, from Columbus Cafe. I brought Tony Orlando to a roast, and then he became a friar.
Oh, wow. I love Tony Orlando. He's a great guy.
Tony Orlando is a wonderful person, and we became friends, and it was, oh, I'm trying to remember what roast. I have a picture. You'll appreciate this. Chevy Chase, Robert De Niro, Tony Orlando, and Robert Merrill.
That's a great shot.
I don't know who that second guy is next to Chevy. I think he was an executive in comedy.
Oh,
he looks very familiar to me.
Yeah, he looks familiar to me, too. I can't quite tell who it is, though.
But that's who it is. Robert De Niro in the middle. It may have been an event honoring Robert De Niro because he didn't often come out to things. Or maybe that was at the Chevy Chase roast.
I think that was the Chevy Chase roast because I think Robert De Niro was at the Chevy Chase roast.
That's probably the very first Chevy Chase roast in 1990 or 1991. I had a story with Buddy Hackett at one of the roasts. Buddy was very insulted that the friars used to offer my services.
Right.
And they would call, they would tell the person, you know, or they would tell me, call so-and-so, he's going to be the roast master. and offer to help him to write jokes. So they gave me Buddy Hackett's number, and I called him up and I introduced myself and I told him I've been writing for the Friars for years. Anyway, I caught him on a bad day and he was very insulted that the Friars would think that he would need help. Now, when you were a roast master, you needed a ton of jokes.
Because you're roasting everybody on the day. It's not just the person who's
you're
being honored.
Everybody, and you need material for in between and every person on the dais. And so anyway, he was very insulted and I think he wound up hanging up on me. The day of the roast, I'm there. I always get there early with all my notes and I would bring extra jokes on cards, on index cards in case anybody needed an extra joke. You know, something like that. And Buddy Hackett came over to me to apologize. And we sat down at a table together. And he said, I just want you to know I'm sorry. He goes, I didn't act well. I was in a bad mood that day or whatever. And it was very kind. And he apologized. And we took pictures together. And years later, so his son was doing a project about a Sandy Hackett.
Yeah, good friend of mine. Sandy's a great guy, too.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And he called me. He was doing a project about the Rat Pack, and I told him that story, and he loved it. He loved the humanity of it, that his dad came over to apologize, and then we took this picture together. Because I always thought Buddy Hackett was great, and obviously I didn't intend to insult him. I said, I wouldn't call you on my own. I'm calling you because the Friars Club asked me to call you. So please don't take it personally, you know, and it wound up great. I mean, it was fine afterwards. But that's how he and I had become friends, because of that little incident.
Jeffrey, I could talk to you all afternoon. But before we go, I want to plug ComedyMattersTV.com.
If any of your listeners are young enough to be on Instagram, I'm at Jeffrey Gurian. I just hope, you know, I'm so happy that you're doing this, Joe, really. People need to know about the Friars Club. It was an amazing institution. You know, for me, the honor having Milton Berle as my sponsor, I think he found that building for them on 55th Street.
He did.
Yeah, he was the person who found it. And to have him as my sponsor was just an unbelievable honor to me. Just to know that we were friends, that I'd be on the phone with him. I'm like, I'm on the phone with Milton Berle. How does that even happen, you know? And so my other things are the YouTube channel is youtube.com/ComedyMattersTV. Go watch the video with Robert Klein and talking about Rodney Dangerfield. But as I said, every comedian is on there. Gilbert, so much stuff with Gilbert. So many Friars events are on there. And
People want to come and see you, you're going to be performing Wednesday, May 10th at 8 p.m. at the Expo, which is located at 610 West 26th Street here in New York City. So I encourage anybody who loves comedy to go see Jeffrey Gurian because he's worked with and known the greats of yesteryear and the greats of today, and he's a great comic in his own right. So I do encourage you to come out and see Jeffrey.
And I'll tell you, if they're fans of this show, if they send me an email, I'll give them a discount code. If they send me an email to jeffrey@jeffreygurian.com, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y. I don't mind giving out my email. jeffrey@jeffreygurian.com. They'll get a discount code thanks to Joe Sebelia and the Friars Club podcast.
Now, before we go, why do you think after all these years at the Friars Club that there's still such a fascination about the Friars?
Because there's never been a place like that before. You know, it was started by some of the greatest comedians of all time. They used to have those round tables where they'd sit around and spritz each other and kibitz and, you know, there's just never been a place like it and there never will be again. But it's an iconic name, just the name itself. Anybody that ever liked comedy knows about the Friars Club because of all the greats that have gone through those doors and hung out there and ate there. And, you know, it was one of the most prestigious things of my career, I can honestly say that, was to be accepted at the Friars Club, to be a longtime friar and to be friends with the people who ran it. one of my greatest honors.
Well, truly. Jeffrey, as a fellow friar, it's, and I'm only 27, I'm on the younger end of the friars, it was such an honor and a pleasure to get to know you at the Friars Club, and I'm so glad that we've become friends, and I hope that you'll come back on the show again, because I have so much more to talk to you about with the Friars Club and your own career, and you're just a fountain of knowledge and a well of great stories and great jokes, so I do hope we'll talk again soon on this show, and off this show, for that matter.
I hope so too, Joe. Anytime you want me, I'm there.
Thanks for listening to the Friars Club podcast. Please be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For more information on the Friars Club, please visit friarsclub.com. We hope to see you there.